Chapter 13. "Please tell me there are others," I say. My mother has just modeled the three hats she purchased for me at the mall. She's still wearing the third one, an absurdly large Victorian tea hat covered with a heaping pile of red roses, along with a slightly deflated smile. "What do you mean? What's wrong with this one? You look like Minnie Pearl." "I do not." The price tag is even dangling over the side of the brim. "Fine, you look crazy." "I have one just like this I wear to my red hat events." She takes the hat off her head and twists it around in her lap, admiring it from every angle. She then smells the fake flowers, returns it to her head, cocks it to the side, and smiles at me as if to say, "What about now?" "Yep, it's a hat made for a crazy lady." "You really didn't get anything else?" She gives me an apologetic shrug instead of an answer and holds up the other two options, a brown leather cowboy hat and a neon pink ski hat. "I felt rushed. It's always chilly in here, so I thought the fleece hat would be good. And Bob has some country music CDs in the car, so I thought you might like that style." I wonder what could possibly have been her reasoning behind the Minnie Pearl. Because she thought I might be just like her? I'm too afraid of that answer to ask. "I'll take the pink one. Minus the fluorescent highlighter color, I'll at least feel like me in a fleece ski hat. Bob and I both love to ski. Bob's family owned a condo in North Conway, New Hampshire, and they used to spend every weekend from December to April on the slopes of Attitash and Cranmore. His happiest childhood memories are of racing his older brothers down a mountain. I, on the other hand, grew up on Cape Cod, where the biggest hills are sand dunes, and we never vacationed over the bridge. I didn't discover skiing until I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, where it's practically part of the core curriculum. My first day on skis was a painful, frozen, and exhausting lesson in humiliation, and the only reason I mustered up the courage to endure another day of pure torture was because I'd purchased a weekend ticket and wanted to get my money's worth. I had no real expectation of improving, never mind enjoying it. But on that second day, a miracle happened. Somehow my clumsy limbs knew where to go and when to go there, and down I went, on my skis and not on my bottom. And I've loved skiing ever since. Bob and I bought our house in Cortland, Vermont, the year after we bought our house in Wellmont. The additional mortgage payment has kept us from being able to afford a bigger house with an additional bedroom in Wellmont, which we need if we ever hope to hire a live-in nanny, but it has been well worth the sacrifice. During the winter months, when we go from house to car to office and back again, and the air inside all those places is overheated, recycled, and contaminated with flu virus, skiing on the weekends means 2 full days of breathing fresh, healthy mountain air. And during those winter months, when we go from house to car to work and back again, we sit. We sit in traffic, sit at our desks, sit through meetings, and sit on the couches with our laptops on our laps. We sit every waking hour of the day until we're too mentally exhausted to sit for one more second. When we go to Vermont, we slide our feet into boots, pop our boots into bindings, and ski. We slalom through moguls, carve through late afternoon icy patches, and swoosh at exhilarating speeds down black diamond trails. We bend and flex and stretch until we're physically exhausted. But unlike the exhaustion we normally experience from sitting all day, this exhaustion is strangely energizing. And there's something magical about the combination of mountain air and physical exercise that interrupts that endlessly looping and insistent voice inside my head that normally chatters on and on about all the things I need to do. Even though it's completely irrelevant now, I can still hear the nagging list that was playing in my head just before the accident. "You need to call Harvard before noon. You need to start year-end performance reviews. You need to finalize the B-School training program for science associates. You need to call the landscaper. You need to email the London office. You need to return the overdue library books. You need to return the pants that don't fit Charlie to the Gap. You need to pick up formula for Linus. You need to pick up the dry cleaning. You need to pick up dinner. You need to make a dentist appointment for Lucy about her tooth. You need to make a dermatologist appointment for you about that mole. You need to go to the bank. You need to pay the bills. Don't forget to call Harvard before noon. Email the London office." By my second or third run down the mountain, that constantly jabbering voice in my head, would be rendered speechless, and a peaceful gratitude would fill the space where all that one-sided, bossy conversation had been. Even when the slopes are crowded with other skiers, and even if Bob and I talk while we ride the chairlift, skiing down to the base is a glorious experience in focused silence. No laundry list in my head, no TV, no radio, no phone, no email. Just the hush of the mountain. Hush. I wish I could bottle it, take it back with me to Wellmont, and sip from it many, many times a day. My mother hands me the hat. I try to put it on, but the opening keeps flopping shut, and I can't get it around my head. It doesn't fit. "Here, let me help," says my mother. She stretches the opening and slides the hat onto my head. It's soft and snug against my skin, and I have to admit, it feels good. "There, you look great," she says, beaming like she's just solved my biggest problem, "and Lucy will love that it's pink." It's strange to hear my mother knowing my kids. She knows that Lucy is crazy for pink. Of course, discovering that Lucy loves the color pink takes about as much time and sensitivity as it does to notice that I'm bald, but still. My mother knows Lucy, my daughter, her granddaughter. "Yeah, she will. Thanks, it's perfect." I touch the hat on my head and close my eyes. I imagine the end of a full day of skiing, sitting on the living room floor in front of a roaring fire with Bob, thawing under thick fleece blankets, eating hot chili and drinking frosty mugs of Harpoon. Sometimes we play backgammon or cribbage, and sometimes we go to bed early. Sometimes we make love right there on the fleece blankets in front of the fire. I smile as I remember the last time. But I stay in the glow of that warm and fuzzy memory for only a second, because now I'm busy flipping back the pages, trying to remember how long ago that frolic took place. God, I don't think we've seen that fireplace in 3 years. Can it really be that long ago? It seems like every time we consider making the trip, a million little excuses collude to keep us from packing up the car and heading north. Work, travel, pregnancy, Charlie's karate lessons on Saturdays in the winter, t-ball games in the spring, various projects around the house, Lucy's ear infections, we're too busy, we're too tired, and now this. I clench my teeth and resolve to eat, drink, and be merry with Bob in front of that fireplace after a long day of skiing this winter. No excuses. The chatter in my head begins reciting a new kind of laundry list. You need to get better. You need to get out of here. You need to go home. You need to go back to work. You need to go to Vermont. You need to get better. You need to get out of here. You need to go home. You need to go back to work. As I become almost hypnotized by this inner mandate, I become increasingly aware of another voice in my head. The voice is a whisper, honest and scared. I recognize it. It is my voice repeating over and over the nagging question that I've been refusing to answer ever since I watched Ellen, ever since I saw Richard and Jessica. What happens if I don't get better? I ask my mother to tell me about her trip to the mall, hoping her prattle will drown out the voice. She happily launches into the story of her outing. What happens if I don't get better? For a whisper, it is remarkably difficult to ignore.